This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 4th, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, Barack Obama returns to the U.S. Senate with an air of victory. Argentina's farmers strike over the country's soy export tax, placing blame on the president. And police go ahead with a plan to set up security checkpoints in the most violent neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. At least two telecom giants have unveiled plans to introduce metered internet service into U.S. markets. This means that customers would be charged according to their web traffic and would have to pay penalties if they exceed their limit. Most internet service providers charge a flat rate for internet connections based on download speeds without limits on traffic. Telecoms say the move would make heavy users pay for their share of network bandwidth, but opponents argue metered internet service could make users shy away from uploading or downloading larger files, like audio and video. Time Warner Cable's metered internet pilot project in Beaumont, Texas, charges basic plan subscribers nearly $30 for a slower-than-average download speed with a 5-gigabyte monthly limit. Comcast announced that it plans to launch a similar pilot program in Warrenton, Virginia, and Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, later this week. In other news, the Pentagon confirmed today that military prosecutors have filed war crimes charges against a British resident held at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. From London, Naomi Fowler has more.
The British Foreign Secretary formally petitioned the US administration to release Binyam Mohamed last summer after years of refusing to intervene in the cases of those held in Guantanamo, who were British residents rather than full citizens. The US charge sheet, released today, accuses Mr. Mohamed of working for Al-Qaeda and planning terrorist operations in the US. A Pentagon official who oversees the tribunal system must first approve the charges before the military tribunal process can begin. But according to Mr. Mohamed's lawyers, the evidence against him is based on statements made after 2 years of brutal torture in Morocco, which included the slashing of his genitals with a scalpel. They filed a lawsuit last month seeking to force the British government to hand over photographic evidence and other documents proving that their client was the victim of torture and so-called extraordinary rendition. Binyam Mohamed faces life imprisonment if convicted. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Canadian Parliament passed a resolution yesterday to allow U.S. war resisters to stay in Canada. All three Canadian opposition parties supported the resolution, which calls on immigration authorities to consider granting permanent residency status to U.S. military personnel who refuse to fight in Iraq. It is unclear how the non-binding resolution will impact active deportation orders pending against several conscientious objectors who currently reside in Canada. In California, only 22% of registered voters cast ballots in yesterday's state primary election. It was feared that low voter turnout could mean passage of an initiative that would have eliminated rent control in more than a dozen cities across the state. But as Andrew Stelzer reports, voters rejected the measure in one of several issues on yesterday's ballot.
The future of rent control for more than 1 million renters and mobile home residents was at stake in California's primary election, but Prop 98 failed with only 39% of the vote. The measure's supporters had campaigned on the premise that its real goal was to stop the government's power to use eminent domain to seize private property, but opponents said it was a hidden agenda scheme to end rent control. With that in mind, Prop 99 was introduced to provide protection against eminent domain seizures without affecting rent control. Prop 99 passed with 62% of the vote. Also in California, Mendocino County voters repealed what had been the most lenient marijuana growing law in the nation. While in the rest of the state, people are allowed to grow up to 6 plants for medicinal use, Mendocino residents had voted 8 years ago to allow for up to 25 plants and use them for anything they chose. But 55% of voters supported a repeal of that law, so Mendocino is now back in line with the statewide 6-plant limit. For FSRN, from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
It's been a tough couple of days for the Chilean government. Truckers have shut their rigs down, clogging highways, demanding a solution to high fuel prices. And today, university and high school students called for a national day of protest against a new education law debated in Congress. FSRN's Jorge Garretón explains.
Students shut down high schools and university campuses today in protest of a new education bill currently debated in Congress. The teachers' union has joined the students with some 5,000 teachers demonstrating in downtown Santiago against the proposed legislation. They say the new education bill, which has multi-party agreement, fails to enshrine public education as a right and gives priority to a for-profit school system. The education bill passed out of committee last night and will now go to the lower house for further debate. The government says this bill is a major step forward and appeal to students and teachers to stop demonstrations. But expectations are that students and teachers' protests will continue for some time. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
And finally, U.S. warships full of humanitarian aid for victims of Cyclone Nargis have been forced to turn away from Burma. Admiral Timothy Keating said the Myanmar military junta denied no fewer than 15 requests to allow the four Navy ships to access the disaster zone to deliver the onboard aid. The United Nations estimates more than 1 million people have yet to receive aid, 1 month after the cyclone slammed into the Irrawaddy Delta rice-producing region. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Senator Barack Obama returned to the Senate today, claiming to be the Democratic presidential nominee. He offered thanks to his colleagues and accepted their congratulations. After the final primaries in South Dakota and Montana yesterday, Obama obtained more than the necessary 2,118 delegates needed to clinch the nomination. Hillary Clinton has yet to concede, but Democratic leaders are urging remaining superdelegates to make their decision and bring the process to a close. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
This day at the U.S. Senate was different than any other. One young senator from Illinois is claiming to be the Democratic nominee, the first African-American presidential nominee of a major party.
America, this is our moment. This is our time. Our time to turn the page on the policies of the past. Our time to bring new energy and new ideas to the challenges we face. Our time to offer a new direction for this country that we love.
Barack Obama crowned himself victor after polls closed in South Dakota and Montana, the final two primary states. Senator Obama was able to defeat Senator Hillary Clinton, who 16 months ago no one thought was beatable. As a relative newcomer to the national political scene, Obama was able to raise more money and ultimately obtain more delegates from voters and from party leaders. Even though he lost a string of key states in the final stretch of the nominating process, including Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia, superdelegates and voters in the Mountain West and the South stood behind him, ultimately placing him over the threshold.
The journey will be difficult. The road will be long. I face this challenge with profound humility and knowledge of my own limitations. But I also face it with limitless faith in the capacity of the American people. Because if we are willing to work for it and fight for it and believe in it, then I am absolutely certain that generations from now, we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when we began to provide care for the sick and good jobs to the jobless. This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal. This was the moment when we ended a war and secured our nation and restored our image as the last best hope on earth.
The day after he reached the nomination tally, Obama stopped in Washington, D.C. to give a speech to the Jewish lobby. Following, he made an appearance at his day job. On the Senate floor, he shook hands, spoke briefly, and accepted congratulations from fellow senators. But Senator Clinton has not yet conceded the nomination. She left her options wide open and invited her supporters to weigh in.
But this has always been your campaign. So to the 18 million people who voted for me and to our many other supporters out there of all ages, I want to hear from you. I hope you'll go to my website at hillaryclinton.com and share your thoughts with me and help in any way that you can.
Even though she too was in Washington Wednesday, she did not appear at the Capitol. Lawmakers offered warm words about her, but also uneasiness about the lack of a definite conclusion. Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri.
Obviously, as a rabid Obama supporter, I would have maybe liked it a little bit better if she hadn't left the door open to this campaign continuing the way she did in terms of some of her rhetoric. But it was a good speech. You
know? The desire for ultimate conclusion also lies at the top of the Democratic Party. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and Democratic Party Chair Howard Dean called on all 130 undecided superdelegates to make their decision by Friday. One who declared Wednesday is former Democratic presidential nominee Walter Mondale. He switched his support from Clinton to Obama. Some speculate that Senator Clinton is pushing for the number two spot, vice president. Senator Obama said he spoke with her briefly. He also said they'll have a longer discussion in the near future. He did not indicate whether she would be his vice president. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Coming up next in our program, community members fight for a voice in New York's Indian Point nuclear power plant relicensing bid. Opposition to the Indian Point nuclear power station in New York has been intense. Entergy, the plant's owner, wants the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to relicense the two nearly 40-year-old reactors for another 20 years. But the nuclear power plant is located 35 miles north of Manhattan and is positioned on an earthquake fault line. And just this morning, the plant's second reactor was taken offline for emergency repairs. Opposition to relicensing has been coming from unprecedented places. For the first time, a state has called for a nuclear power plant to be closed. New York's Attorney General Andrew Cuomo was quoted in the New York Times as saying Indian Point should be closed and it should be closed now, and that Indian Point is, in my opinion, a catastrophe waiting to happen. And as Christine Black reports from New York, citizen groups are worried the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is curtailing public participation under the guise of streamlining the relicensing process.
In mid-March, the attorneys general of New York, Connecticut, and local government and environmental groups went before the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board. This three-judge panel is set up by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to evaluate license renewal applications. In this initial phase, the judges will decide which contentions or arguments against the plant will be given a hearing in the next phase of the license renewal process. But only two-thirds of the total 150 contentions were heard in March. Lawyers from a group known as WestCan, including grassroots environmental organizations Sierra Club and Assemblyman Richard Brodsky, were unavailable during those 3 days of testimony. So the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board rescheduled the group's oral arguments for the first day of April, a standard practice, according to Susan Shapiro, WestCan's lead attorney.
Hearings in any court of law are scheduled based on the availability of the parties and their attorneys. If somebody's not available, it's rescheduled up to two or three times.
But on March 25th, the group was notified that its April 1st appearance was canceled. The order from the ASLB stated that any questions the board had for WestCan were answered in WestCan's written pleadings or during oral arguments given by other groups in March. Neil Sheehan is spokesman for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
The commission gives wide discretion to these administrative law judge panels to handle a hearing as they see fit.
The prejudicial part about it is every other group had an opportunity to support their contentions.
Susan Shapiro.
We feel they're really trying to get rid of us on procedural stuff, and they do not want to deal with the substance of our contentions.
And so WestCan sent a letter protesting the ASLB's decision. They were concerned that without a public hearing, it would be easier for the ASLB to dismiss their contentions and supporting evidence on technicalities. Technicalities that would be easily amended, according to Shapiro, in a regular court of law. In response, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission drafted an order dated April 30th that said, quote, "Oral argument on contention admissibility is not a right," end quotes. Neil Sheehan.
the judges, you know, after they looked at all the information they had gathered from White Plains, determined they really had enough at that point, and that further oral arguments would have just been repetitive.
West Cannes, Susan Shapiro.
Our contentions are very different from other groups. How did they get this information about our contentions that they didn't have before? That's the underlying question.
West Cannes' contentions are in fact unique. At least 10 had never been heard in any form during the hearings on White Plains, while others utilized different approaches and evidence.
In the process of researching the contentions that we were writing, I was looking up something on Google about stainless steel corrosion and accidentally fell upon a website.
It was the website of Doosan Heavy Industry and Construction, the manufacturer of various nuclear products. It showed that Entergy had ordered reactor vessel heads for both Indian Point 2 and 3 for delivery by 2011 and 2012, respectively. Entergy is required to disclose its plans to maintain and refurbish the plant for the next 20 years in its relicensing application.
They pretended that there would be no changes of that nature at all and just left it out.
The NRC staff agreed that this contention should have standing. 9 other contentions addressed fire safety at the plant. According to Shapiro, wraps used on electrical cables are supposed to withstand fire for up to an hour.
For the last 15 years, Congress has been demanding that the NRC do proper testings of these fire wraps. What the NRC did, instead of doing testing before they used them at plants, is they looked at the advertisement that the manufacturer put out that said it was good for an hour. They never did independent testing of it.
When the NRC tested the wraps, they only withstood fire for 24 minutes. And instead of requiring Entergy to retrofit, Brodsky says the NRC reduced the standard to 24 minutes.
And they did it in secrecy, in violation of their rules, and in a way that endangers the public safety.
The NRC spokesman declined to comment on specific contentions. It's still early in the relicensing process for Indian Point. The Atomic Safety and Licensing Board still has to rule which of the 150 contentions, if any, will be given a hearing. Marilyn Ellie is cautiously optimistic.
We're hoping that out of the many contentions that we've submitted, at least 2 or 3 of them will get in so that we will have a place at the table at the hearings.
A decision about which of the contentions will be heard is expected in late May or June. The decision whether to relicense Indian Point is not expected for several years. For FSRN, I'm Christine Black.
Argentina's farmers are on strike again over a soy export tax. They have set up blockades on major highways to prevent grain trucks from delivering to ports. In response, today, frustrated truckers set up roadblocks of their own on rural roads, shutting down all traffic. In the face of this, the country's president, Cristina Fernandez, is facing waning support and harsh criticisms over her handling of the conflict. FSRN's Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has confronted the influential farmers who have barricaded highways and prevented grain from making it to export in recent months. Farmers began their protest after the government implemented a tax on soy exports at a rate of 45%, up from 35% in early March. The debate over soy has riveted the country and has proven to be a major crisis for the first woman-elected president of Argentina. Kirchner claims that the commodity boom can be used to redistribute wealth to Argentina's 8 million poor. She also raised concerns over Argentina's ability to feed its people, the environmental effects of soy cultivation, and inflation on food products. At a protest against increasing inflation on food in the nation's capital, community organizer Leandro Molina says that social services have deteriorated despite government claims.
El planteo de la redistribución de la riqueza que hace el gobierno discursivamente.
The proposal of redistributing the commodity boom that the government uses in their speeches is not having a real effect in people's economic conditions. The only thing that has changed is that there's less unemployment, but jobs are very precarious. In fact, the money from the soy export tax isn't going to the people. Housing, education, and health haven't improved. But still, the government should continue to impose the high tax hike because it prevents prices on basic food products from going up even more.
Por el hecho de que impiden que suban todavía más los precios de los alimentos populares.
Argentina's economy has made an incredible recovery since the 2001 financial crisis. Unemployment is down, exports growing, and inflation rates are highly disputed. The government's official inflation rate is 10%, but independent analysts put that rate at 20%. And as inflation rises, Fernandez de Kirchner's approval rating continues to slide from 45% down to 23% since she took office in December. Some see her handling of the farmers' conflict as heavy-handed. The most recent round of talks between farmers and government representatives collapsed. Economist Alan Sibbles says there are a couple of factors that are whittling away at the president's support.
I think most people think that she's not governing effectively. She's handled this crisis very poorly. I think there's also widespread perception, which is not unfounded, that the person really running government is her husband behind the scenes, or in the best case, it's her husband and herself.
Fernandez de Kirchner's administration has been accused of squandering resources on patronage and public spending in the height of a commodities boom. Argentina is a leading producer of soy and grains at the global level, trailing the United States and Brazil as leading soy producers. In 2006, Argentina produced more than 47 million tons of soy. In many regions, soy has displaced traditional food crops and farmers to urban areas. Roque Acuña is an organic farmer from a movement of peasants in the northern province of Santiago del Estero.
The government is interested in the soy export tax, but we don't know what they want to use the tax for. When they should be distributing the taxes amongst the people, the money doesn't make it. What the government wants is to gain economic power, but not to distribute it amongst the people. What is occurring now is a fight between two economic powers in which the people don't have participation. Argentina needs food sovereignty.
With a spike in inflation and the prolonged farmer strike, Argentina's president will have to face increasing pressure to resolve the export tax conflict. Argentina is a leading grain exporter to Europe and China, and an extended strike could impact world grain prices, which are already at an all-time high. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona, Buenos Aires.
Violent crime is on the rise in several neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. In response, the Metropolitan Police Department and Mayor Adrian Fenty have authorized setting up checkpoints in designated areas that will require every vehicle going in or out to stop and be identified. Naji Mujahid has more from the nation's capital.
D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty, along with the police chief, D.C. Attorney General, and members of the City Council and Advisory Neighborhood Commissioners gathered at a recreation center in the Trinidad neighborhood of the city, which is one of four areas targeted to begin the new initiative. These extreme measures will include police checkpoints that will not allow anybody through until after their identity is verified and their reason for entering is legitimate. This is part of a larger attempt to control crime and in response to 72 homicides since January. This, despite the fact that crime has decreased over the past 20 years, according to the mayor. That notwithstanding, he believes that certain areas need special attention. Mayor Adrian Fenty.
What we're trying to do is just say in certain areas, and for one reason or another, this area has been the area where there's been the most violent crime in this calendar year, we need to go beyond the normal methods of policing, the normal ways that we try and enforce a particular area and use the strength of the law to the benefit of the community.
This new initiative is one of many abnormal methods employed by the D.C. Police Department over the past year. Others include door-to-door searches for weapons, surveillance cameras and so-called hotspots, and the more recent arming of the police with military assault rifles. Shelley Broderick, president of the D.C. area ACLU and dean of the UDC Law School, commented on the latest in this trend and called it unconstitutional.
I'm deeply depressed and disappointed that they've come up with a policy that allows them to go into quote-unquote high crime areas, which actually by case law in D.C. is the entire city. But we know where they're going to go. They're going to go to low-income areas for the most part, and stop and interrupt the lives of our citizens with no particularized suspicion that criminal activity is afoot and that this particular individual is involved.
Ronald Moten, co-founder and COO of the community organization Peaceaholics, says unaddressed social issues are a major factor of the violence in the community, and he challenged the typical reaction to increased police presence.
I give you a prime example.
That's
like
real.
Every child
that's been killed around here, I guarantee you, I will bet my next paycheck on it. None of their siblings have gotten counseled. You want to make a bet on that? And when you don't, when somebody's close to you is killed, and you don't get counseling, eventually it explodes and come out, and you end up being a violent person. So when I talk about social issues, I'm not just talking about jobs. I'm talking about everything that causes a person to be violent. And what we do is we always talk about we need more police.
These checkpoints could be set up immediately where violent crime is present. The initiative will begin this weekend. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Najee Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Now, from Pennsylvania Death Row, a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
When votes matter, and when they didn't. As national officials of the Democratic Party struggle and squabble over the votes of both Florida and Michigan, and determine the allocation of delegates, the ghost of the 2000 presidential election rises again. This may be seen most starkly in the repeated refrain of the campaign of Senator Hillary Clinton, who has been so vociferous in her demand that every vote count, that she has likened the recent campaign to the political struggle raging in Zimbabwe. There's only one problem with this kind of born-again, every-vote-count democracy. Neither Senator Clinton nor many of her supporters made that demand in the 2000 presidential campaign, nor did a single U.S. senator stand with members of the Congressional Black Caucus when they, members of the U.S. House of Representatives, needed one senatorial vote to formally investigate the thousands of stolen votes, especially among black Floridians. Not one senator, not Senator Clinton, not Senator John Kerry, not Senator John Edwards, not then-Senator Al Gore, not one. We don't know if it would have made a difference, but it certainly would have been better, more democratic, than simply sweeping it under the rug. It's been 8 years, and Florida is back with us with a vengeance. For many people who remember the shenanigans of Florida, the allure of voting lost much of its luster. Who stood for those tens of thousands of black voters in 2000 who were blatantly disenfranchised? The Congressional Black Caucus, beholden as it was to the Democratic Party, was virtually powerless. And party heads advised quiet acquiescence to this electoral theft. What immense human suffering might have been averted both here and in Iraq had people in power been willing to fight for those who voted for them. But that was not to be. That acquiescence has given birth to the present political hour, one which threatens to rend the Democratic Party in two. As the English playwright Tom Stoppard has said in his novel Jumpers, it's not the writing that's democracy, it's the counting. Florida, like an ingrown toenail, cannot be ignored. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Kristen Schwartz. Headlines editor Shannon Young, DC editor Leanne Caldwell, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Oscar Hernandez, Eric Klein, Puck Lowe, and Rose Khadabji. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.